Hey there, are you looking for more of a multidisciplinary approach to pediatric therapy? Whether you are a clinician or a parent or just a community partner interested in pediatric therapy, this podcast is for you. We examine a variety of topics, looking at it from all angles. On this podcast, we'll have a panel of 2 to 3 participants talking about a variety of topics that we get from our Facebook group. So we have 2 different Facebook groups that you can join. One is specifically for clinicians only, and that's called the Peds Therapy Collective. The other group is more of a parent empowerment group. We're looking to help encourage and empower parents to understand that they have everything they need within them right now to help their child. And just for a little bit of support, we have our clinicians there in the group to help give guidance and point you in the right direction, get you down that right path to feeling successful with working with your child in whatever therapy they need, whether it's speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, maybe they're seeing a vision therapist, maybe they're working with an ABA therapist. Wherever you are right now, maybe your child is dealing with dyslexia, autism, ADHD, we really want to support you because our pediatric therapists have many specialties, and we're here to help kind of bring everybody's knowledge together and offer that to you, and also offer it to our clinicians so that we can better educate ourselves and really grow as professionals. So sit back and listen to our episode. Welcome to the Peds Therapy Collective. Today I'm really excited to talk with a friend of mine and a fellow therapist, Mona Reedy, and she's also a mom, so there may be some little children joining us. No big deal. Luckily, I've sent mine off to school already, but Mona Reedy is a ECSC here in the Denver area. Before we get started with some of the questions that we had from the Facebook group, Mona, why don't you tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do as a pediatric therapist?
Hi, Christine. Thanks for having me. So I am an ECSC. I have some experience working since, I think, 2012. I kind of have worked in early intervention in a variety of capacities. I was first a coordinator, and then I decided, you know, my undergrad was in speech, and I thought, you know, I'd like to go ECSC, and so I went back to grad school after being a service coordinator for almost 4 years, and then I've been practicing since 2015 as a pediatric developmental therapist. And I think a lot of parents always have questions on ECSC and what that means. And really, I like to explain it to parents that we're really kind of globally trained. And every provider, you know, in early intervention is really globally trained. But really, we don't really specialize in just one thing. We can specialize in just one thing, but we usually kind of have a knowledge base in all areas of development that we look at. Kind of the areas that I really thrive in are speech and language and play skills. And that's kind of what I really like to do. So we really work on preparing kids for speech and language with play, and definitely motor, obviously motor and play before speech and language. But those are kind of what I like to really work on. So yeah, that's basically what I do in a nutshell. And some sleep here and there. So.
Well, that's awesome. That's so important. And I think for a lot of families, they don't necessarily have, you know, the child wasn't that delayed in any of these skills, but yet overall they need help supporting this play. And so it's great that early intervention has ECSEs and those special educators to support kids in that, in the more global aspect. So yay.
Well, and I really, and to your point, I think it's hard for parents to understand how everything intertwines and all these skills really play off of each other. So sometimes, you know, parents will say, oh, you just really want my child to talk, which is understandable. But there's all these other things that have to happen before that can happen. So I think it's really good to be able to explain that to parents, that these skills are not isolated. They really, I mean, really, it's everything relies on each other, all these skills. So.
Yes. And that is the core principle of our podcast here, of our Facebook group too, that Peds Therapy Collective, to understand that
we all are related, and you are lucky enough to be able to get training and exposure and all of that. So I'm sure that just feels second nature to you.
Yeah, it does. I really enjoy being able to educate parents on development and how all of these things interact. So well,
you're a perfect person to have on my panel. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We will get started with some of the questions that we had in the Facebook group. The first one that came up was around feeding, specifically related to children who may have a G-tube or are unable to eat by mouth. So there's a variety of reasons why a child might not be able to eat, get their nutrition orally through their mouths, and they might be need to be fed either through an G-tube, one that goes up and through their nose, or perhaps through a G-tube in their belly, in their abdomen. And so, you know, as a physical therapist or even at ECSC, we may kind of wonder, what can we do to help stimulate swallow and keep the muscles in the mouth and the jaw strong and working? So we have some responses from the Facebook group, so I'll go over those first, but please jump in if you have anything to add. So the one therapist recommended, you know, to continue to play with food, even if they're not going to be eating it. So she gave an example of using Greek yogurt in finger painting with that. So maybe adding a little bit of food coloring, and on their high chair, kind of being able to touch the textures of that and get the smells. Have you ever done anything like that, Mona, with anybody?
I have. I can think back to one specific kiddo that I worked with. He had a really rare genetic disorder, and one of the rarest. He's actually in a medical journal. And he had a G-tube I still stay in touch with his mom periodically, and I believe he's still on a G-tube. And that was one of our main strategies I worked closely with the nutritionist. She was a nutritionist at Children's, as well as a feeding therapist who was an OT. And speech, he also had speech therapy that specialized in feeding, but that was one of the main things that we did with him. Because he also had other aversions. And he had really never had solid food. He was really on a pureed, 100% pureed diet. And one of the things that we did when we were introducing new textures and solids was just different tastes. We would have him play with thicker textured purees, thinner purees, different smells. We would have him work on smelling them, playing with them. We did a lot of kind of, you know, the yogurt. We even did some whipping cream, play with him. We even did food sensory bins. Actually, the OT that I worked with was really great for feeding, and she had him do all sorts of bins with different foods. So even vegetables, we did yogurt. There was, she even had him do a spaghetti noodle one, just to kind of work on expanding what he was able to tolerate. So it was really an awesome experience getting to work alongside her and learn how to continue to work on food when, you know, unfortunately he was not able to take food orally.
That's a great point. And I've never thought about making a vegetable bin to play with. And I think,
yeah, it was parent, really cool.
As a parent, you're like, no, don't get messy, or,
right.
You know, how would that possibly help? And maybe your child might not even be ready to touch some of those foods at first. So we can even just start from us. I mean, we're all sensory beings. So one of our senses would just be visually looking at it if they're not ready to touch it.
Right. Absolutely.
And then just kind of working closer to them being able to be comfortable. What about, you know, we really want the child to do this skill now, but they're resistive. How do you bridge that gap between getting them in a calm space to explore something that they really don't want to do?
I think it's really important, just kind of as a general strategy, just to meet them where they're at. And if they're not ready, and you're specifically talking about like a food choice, right? Or are you just talking in general? Are you talking about the feeding piece?
In this case, I would even just say just touching the food. Like, it's great. Let's have these sensory bins, or let's play with this whipping cream. But the kid is like, no.
Right. Well, and I think the most important thing that I've learned when working with kids who have sensory differences is getting them to just visually tolerate it. So with this kiddo, he did have a lot of sensory aversion. So the OT would basically put some different foods in front of him and kind of just have him visually look at them without even touching them. Like, that was kind of the first step for this kiddo that we were working with. And we would kind of try the same food, you know, for a few sessions at a time, you know. So for example, take the yogurt, right? Like just even visually tolerating it on his tray, on his high chair.
Right.
And then, you know, after so many exposures, he was more willing to touch it and engage with it. So it, and I think that's what's hard for parents is that visual acceptance, they have to visually accept it on their plate before they're willing to even touch it and play with it. And then that leads to, you know, putting it to their mouth and then licking it or smelling it and then eating it, you know. So there's all of these steps that have to happen. And I think, you know, I think one of the main things that I think teaching parents to in this situation is it doesn't seem like it's a big deal to us as parents, the way maybe something visually looks or the way that it smells or the way that it feels. But for these little guys, it's really hard sometimes to visually tolerate something on their plate. So I think the hardest challenge when working with parents and, you know, just even as a therapist is not pushing the kids too much. So I think getting them in that place of where they feel safe. And that's really important because it is almost like a reaction. Like they don't really have a choice in how they respond to specific foods or textures. It's just, it's a very normal response. It's kind of that fight or flight. Oh, right, this is scary. I don't like it. And so if we can meet them where they're at and just really go slow, I think you're, you know, oftentimes you have much more success than kind of forcing with that. And I've worked with, you know, rightfully so, feeding can be a very scary issue. And some parents are like, I just want them to eat. So then they force them to do things that are, you know, are scarier. And so I think with the professional's help, you know, just learning how can we meet them where they're at and still grow,
yes.
Which can be hard sometimes to identify, you know, how we're going to do that. So
yeah. That's very important. And the timeline, your child's timeline may be different than yours as a parent or yours as a therapist, like not everything
right
in a 60-minute session. So just being patient and, like you said, support and stretch our children. That's super. So we can also do things like smelling spices or smelling different essential oils that may be similar to different foods if we're moving on beyond just or trying to increase other senses besides just sight and touch. Another
right.
therapist mentioned that if you are feeding them through the G-tube, trying to still have the child participate with meal times, sitting up at the table, sitting up in their high chair, and if it's
yes.
possible at all, having them receive the tube-fed nutrition during that same time. So that's not always possible, but it would be.
No, and I totally agree with that. That's one of the main strategies that the OT that I was working with was using, in addition to having the parent also model what eating was. So not only was mom having, you know, participating in mealtime, or the child was participating in mealtime, but so was mom. So mom was modeling what to do with a spoon, telling the child to swallow, you know, using those terms, swallow. Because, I mean, this kiddo was on purees, but so he was learning how to do all of those things. But I think that was a great strategy too, is that the parents need to be modeling what mealtimes can look like for kids.
Right. That's very important. And to slow down and every family should be trying to have that togetherness because eating is much more than just nutrition. It's a social time. It's a time for community with your family. So just building those routines in. Again, we're both parents of three children, so we know that this is sometimes easier said than done. But
right.
striving for that routine so that our children know what to expect. And they're always observing what we're doing, even probably more so than listening to what we're saying. They're always modeling what we're doing.
Right, absolutely.
Moving on to the oral motor control, another therapist mentioned that part of the swallow is initiated as the tip of the tongue comes upward mm-hmm. or elevates. And so doing activities, either using a mirror or using different tools like a Nook brush to help direct that tongue upward and getting that elevation working. So that was one strategy. There was another strategy to work on lip closure. So being able mm-hmm. to hold various things in the mouth, but using the lips. So holding the spoon in your mouth, only using your lips. The other therapists mentioned a kazoo, harmonica, straws to blow feathers, cotton balls, paper, flavored chewy tubes that they like that flavor to have it in their mouth and work on kind of lip closure. Any other strategies?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No, those are all the ones that I'm familiar with. I've had some therapists, the only addition I can think of is, you know, kissing things. I've had some therapists work on lip closure with kissing. So, you know, giving mom kisses, blowing kisses. Some kids who have a hard time with that lip rounding and lip closure, you know, their face is kind of flat, if that makes sense. So when they go in for the kiss, they're not really, that movement isn't really pronounced. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's fun to work on blowing with bubbles. That's, I've also done that because most kids really enjoy bubbles. So that's a really fun activity to get them to blow, to get some of that lip closure.
Sure.
So that's the only other addition that I can think of that I've worked on with kids or seen other therapists do.
And the kissing is great too, because then we get that social emotional aspect mm-hmm. of it, and being able to say goodbye, and we can play little games where we're hiding under a blanket, or maybe we hide behind the couch and then we say hello. So there's opportunities for language, whether that's verbal language or using sign, or if they're using an AAC device. So you also mentioned about kind of shaping the lips or shaping the cheeks. And my suggestion in the group was to do some facial massage, or massage
yes.
the earlobes and to behind the ears, because that can stimulate vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is correlated to all of our parasympathetic or the autonomic nervous system, all those automatic features like swallow, saliva production. So we can stimulate that vagus nerve behind the ears, inside the ear, like along the bottom part of the earlobe, all along the neck muscle, that sternocleidomastoid muscle, that large thick muscle that connects behind the ear down to the clavicle, your collarbone, can be mm-hmm. a handle to stimulate the vagus nerve. And in addition to just massages on the cheeks and pulling the face from the ear down gently toward the lips to create that closure that you're talking about.
Right.
So there you go. So, all right. So that's some great feedback and nice teaming. Here we are, two people trying to team together everybody's ideas, but I think we're doing a pretty good job.
I think so too.
Let's move on to our next topic, which in the Facebook group, I started something called Random Object Sunday. And the point of this is, especially as an EI therapist, you and I both know we aren't supposed to be bringing things into the home. Really, we want to work and meet the family where they're at and use what is available to us in the home. So that sometimes can mean some pretty random objects. So I thought I would challenge everybody in the group to come up with some treatment strategies. So the setup of this particular challenge includes a child who is developmentally 10 to 12 months of age. So that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how old the child is, but that's where their skills are. So they really are just starting to understand what you're saying. They maybe are doing some babbling or some repetitive sounds, but not really having any words yet. The child is pulling up to stand, standing with support at the couch, maybe taking steps sideways, but not yet walking independently. So anything else that you would kind of associate with a child who's 10 to 12 months, Mona?
No, I'm trying to think. You know, definitely probably 10 to 12 months, really exploring with their environment. You know, hopefully they're starting to imitate their caregivers would be another thing that I would really look for. Some first words starting to appear. Like
okay.
you said, that reduplicated babbling.
Cause and effect
yeah.
type of things.
Understand. Cause and effect, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we've got these three objects. I have two boxes of macaroni and cheese that have the noodles inside, a light up bouncy ball, and a small blanket. So if you were doing a treatment strategy with this child, what's something that you would do, and you could use any or none of those objects, I suppose.
Okay, so light up bouncy ball was one of the objects, right?
Yeah.
Two boxes of mac and cheese.
Yes.
And a blanket.
Yeah.
So if a child was 10 to 12 months, I think, well, I mean, I saw some of the responses on your Facebook post, which were great, but I would really work on imitation.
Mm-hmm.
I love the social emotional piece too, like, you know, the imitation of rolling a ball back and forth, the social piece that brings, bringing in the caregiver. So rolling a ball back and forth with mom and the baby or the child and the therapist. I, depending on how old the child is and some other skills, one thing I think balls are really super fun. I haven't really met a lot of toddlers that don't like to play with balls. Is I really like to work on what we can do with an object. So yes, you want to work on labeling as a therapist, you know, labeling things in their environment, but also I'm a huge person on advocating for verbs. So we can bounce the ball, we can roll the ball, we can throw the ball, you know, just kind of being able to expand on that. So depending on, you know, this, obviously it would depend on this kiddo's gross motor skills and ability and things like that. But that's kind of a next step that I like to work on are verbs with kids, because then you can really show them and parents what you can do, which can also lead to choices when they get to that point where they're able to make a choice. So do you want to, you know, want to roll the ball or bounce the ball? Mm-hmm. And you're also working on that understanding of what those items mean. So rolling a ball back and forth. With the blanket idea, I really love playing peekaboo for that social emotional piece. You know, babies love that. And it's super fun to involve, you know, mom and dad into that session as well, and getting them to play peekaboo back and forth with. And it's all about that back and forth piece. So whether you're rolling the ball back and forth, or, you know, the baby covers, you know, you cover up the baby and then you cover up yourself with the blanket, you're really working on that reciprocal piece of play. And really that's what language is turn taking. So, and then with a box of mac and cheese, honestly, I would probably open them up and do a sensory bin. As long as the child is safe and not putting things too much in their mouth or can have fun, that would be super fun depending on some of those factors. But the other piece too is working on imitation again. So you can work on shaking the box, even stacking the boxes, and maybe even a sensory bin, just depending on their age and what, you know, if they're safe and not putting every single thing in their mouth. Developmentally, I would assume a 10 to 12 month would be putting things in their mouth, but you never know. And you could probably try something like that too. So.
Excellent. I like those ideas. Yeah. Those are things that I didn't think about doing. so for like me, of course, I was the one that came up with the three random objects. So maybe that's not quite fair. But I think I would, you know, we're pulling up to stand at the couch, and I could have the ball at the end of the couch, and they could, you know, I light it up. And so then they're going to take steps over to that ball. Because they see,
which is really motivating.
Yeah. And then maybe at that point, you know, we could see if they know how to activate it again, or I could show them that so I can incorporate what you just said about
cause and effect.
Yeah. And so then maybe we'll go back the other way, but this time I'm going to put the ball under the blanket. So they should have object permanence at this stage, meaning that they should realize that something is there. Once I put it under something or take it away, they should remember that it's still there.
And look for it. Absolutely.
Yeah, especially if it's lighted up, that might also draw their attention. If it you know, they can kind of see that through the blanket a little bit. So we can do that as we cruise back and forth or take side steps. The macaroni and cheese, yeah, I was thinking of stacking them and knocking them down, maybe using like language like ready, set, go, or my turn. And, you know, I could stack them up, they can knock them down. Maybe you can expand on that and seeing if they can figure out how to stack it up. Which stacking, you know, not all kids like to stack blocks. So we could look at stacking anything in your house, books, diapers, boxes of macaroni and cheese. So that if your child doesn't seem to be interested, because that's one of those questions on the, you know, the 12-month checkup at the doctor is your child stacking blocks? Well, maybe not because they don't like it, but what else? But the point of that is not that they stack the blocks per se, is that they have the visual motor to stack anything.
Right.
So that's in small blanket too. Like I love to make a magic carpet ride. So working on trunk control, working on communication. So I'll put the child on the blanket and pull them. And then I'll stop and I'll wait for them to either say more or sign more or give me some eye contact that they want to do it again. So we can go fast, we can go slow. So we can talk about those words and getting them on and off the floor. Then if they're not yet walking, we can still work on transitions. So a blanket and putting things down on the floor and then up on the couch and motivating the child to move their body through those positions. That's how I would use those objects.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a great point too, working on some of those words like boom, or even like if, you know, if you're pulling them on the blanket for to work on trunk control, wee or whoa or boom or crash, I really like working on those words, you know, for imitation, which are really fun. Most kids really like to do that. Or, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And those are really easy ones to, you know, imitate.
Right, because those exclamatory words or those environmental mm-hmm. sounds are very different in our language than all the other words that we're saying. You know, how many words right. do they speak in a minute? And how is that child able to really pick up on that language if we are kind of starting with them with a word or a sound that grabs their attention? They're excited to say that. Like you said, a communication or language is all about communicating something between two people. So right. using those expressions can really get kids excited about using words.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. Thanks for.
Yeah. I like your random object Sunday.
Beautiful.
It makes you think as a therapist, because I think, like you said, you know, as in EI, as therapists, we're really instructed not to bring a bag in, and that's kind of our safety zone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can bring in stuff that we can control and we know what we're going to work on. And then, so, you know, when I was a really new therapist, you know, I would kind of rely on some of that, and I've really evolved over the years to really, really, you know, take that in and really use it to push me to be a better therapist and use what the family has. And I just think, I don't know, after a few years of doing it this way, of not bringing in a bag, or, you know, if I bring in something, I'll leave it with the family. I think I've seen much more success and much more carryover and much more parent involvement. And I think it's wonderful. So.
Yes. Yeah. And the research is there to show that early intervention and bag-less therapy is really the best practice. So it's a
And I think it's really important. Oh, sorry, Christine, go ahead. No, I just think it's important to get that message out to parents too. And I know there's parents that listen to this podcast that's really what the research supports, and that's what's really effective, that, you know, you can use anything in your house to work on gross motor or play or language. It doesn't have to be a bag of toys. It doesn't have to look like what we're doing and coming in and working on these specific isolated skills for an hour or, you know, things like that. I think it's really important for parents to know that, that really is what is effective and what works.
Right. Awesome. That's super. We are going to kind of wrap up here and get started talking about some resources for families. So I know that you have a couple of resources that you post on your personal page, and I've started to share mm-hmm. in our Facebook group. Why don't you talk about who Melanie Potok is and Munchbug?
Yeah. So I, funny story. So Melanie Potok is a feeding therapist, and she's based outside of Boulder, and she's a speech therapist, but she specializes in feeding. And I happen to grow up with her daughter. So I know her personally. Uh-huh. I never knew when I went into speech and, you know, when I was going through my speech program that this is what she did until I started reading a lot of her research. So I grew up playing softball with her daughter, Carly, and we've been really good family friends for a long time. So it's been super fun to be able to get to know her as a professional. So I really got to know her, A, through reading her research when I was going through my speech program and really what was recommended for feeding. But I also, my oldest daughter, who is 5 and a half, struggled with feeding when she was little. She had a significant tongue tie, and breastfeeding was super hard, and then she had some torticollis, and so then all of this somehow, you know, all of it really impacted her ability to feed. And so Melanie happened to have our same insurance, and she actually provided feeding therapy for my child for Reese when she was really little. So it was really fun to not only work with her on a professional level now, but also have her expertise as a parent, and I've learned a lot from her. And she's an amazing resource. So for parents, she has a Facebook page, and she also has her private page, like her website, and she has all sorts of feeding resources for parents and for therapists. And the number one thing that she really preaches is playing with food. And she has her 3E. I don't know if you've looked much into her, Christine, but she has her 3E approach, which is, I believe, expose, expand, explore, or explore, expand, expose. I can't remember the order of them, but anyways, she's really big on just getting kids to explore food visually, tactily, and working with them on expanding, you know, expanding what they're able to tolerate. And I just love her suggestions. I mean, she has so many friendly books. I could go on and on. I could just rave about her all day long, but, I just really like how she approaches eating. It's like you said earlier in the podcast, it really is more than just eating. It's a social time. it's, you know, some of the time where you get to spend time with your kids and learn about their day and explore new foods. You know, in one of her books, you know, Adventures in Veggie Land really talks about like how much a garden, you know, just having a few things, you know, getting kids involved in that meal process, the gardening process, picking vegetables, bringing them inside, you know, cutting them up, washing them, playing with them. I mean, how these things, and really with feeding therapy and with kids who have feeding or, you know, food aversions, it's really just more exposure. And of course we can't expect every kid to like, you know, every single food, but they can learn to tolerate it. They can learn to do tough things. And that's what I like, that she teaches parents that it's okay to be afraid of eating a specific food, but we can do hard things. And so she's absolutely amazing. I use a lot of her resources for parents. She has some specific handouts that I give to families. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of parents have a hard time structuring meal times and snack times. And so one of her handouts that's on her website, is an ideal feeding schedule for toddlers. So that's one of them. And she also has what kids should have per age. So like, you know, when they're between the years of 2 and 4, this is what they should have for vegetables and meat and carbs and dairy. And I think that's really a nice handout for a visual handout for parents to say, okay, this is what my child should be getting. So it kind of gives them something to shoot for. And I'm always recommending her books. She has, I think, 3 or 4 books now. So anyways, I really adore her, and she's fabulous. I mean, just to work on her as a parent myself, and now as a professional, she's really amazing.
Well, that's a great endorsement for Melanie. Maybe we need to have her.
I know. I'm like, you should have her on your podcast.
Totally. Yeah. No. And I'm about to go see a little girl who actually needs some of this information. So I'll be happy to share. Well, we're going to wrap it up here today, and we have so much more that we could have covered this morning, but we'll have to do that another day. Mona, would you like to come back sometime?
I would really love to come back and share my other resources.
I think we'll have to set.
And for other things, but.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, it was a great time talking with you today. And I hope everybody out there listening got something beneficial from this. So you can also be on this podcast. It's super easy, right, Mona?
It's super easy.
So I'll have a link.
If I can do it, anyone can do it.
There you go, because you can do hard things too, Mona.
I can do hard things too. It's only Tuesday and I can do hard things.
But there'll be a Sign Up Genius link in the show notes, so take a look at that. Reach out to me. You can reach me on email, on Facebook, Christine Physical Therapist. So please, I would love to talk to you. Join our Facebook groups and participate, because we want to build this community. And I'm so happy to have so many people excited to do the same thing. So, all right, everybody, have a great day.
Hi, it's Christine from the PEDS Therapy Collective podcast, as well as the Healthcare Advocacy podcast. And today I wanted to tell you about a volunteer organization that I helped co-found with Kristen Parsons. It's called Nightlight Inpatient Parent Support, and it's a free hotline for parents when they're in the hospital to reach out to another mom or dad who has been there before. So being in the hospital with your kid can be a very lonely and scary place, even if you're just there for a few days. And yes, there is support staff in the hospital, social workers, pastors, chaplains, but another parent to vent to, another parent to just talk about where the best coffee shop is, or what are they going to do now, just to get some of those feelings and thoughts out of their head and into a space that's safe for them, was something that was missing. And I know that the hospitals themselves can't provide it because of all of the privacy regulations, so that's why Kristen and I made this group. So what we need from you is word of mouth, getting this out to parents, families, hospitals. Right now this is starting in Denver, but we really want this to be a nationwide program We have about 10 volunteers right now who are waiting to get a phone call from somebody. And all it requires is the parent calls in, lets us know what's going on, and we get back to the parent within 24 hours. So it's a really simple process. We just need help getting the word out that we even exist. And the advertising that is on this podcast and the Healthcare Advocacy Podcast will go directly to purchasing items for us to be able to distribute across the nation. So whether that is business cards or pamphlets or flyers, it will help us grow as an organization. So thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Please share it with your family and friends, and search for the Healthcare Advocacy Podcast as well, because that is another great resource for you to learn about all aspects of healthcare advocacy.